Hi, this is Bill Lindeke for the Streets.mn podcast, conversations about transportation, public space, and urban design in the Twin Cities. The podcast this week is a conversation with David Levinson, a professor in the Department of Civil Engineering at the University of Minnesota. David is also a co-founder and regular writer here at Streets.mn, and I'm sure you're used to reading his work and seeing his name here on the page. His work focuses on transportation networks and measurements of efficiency for different road and transit systems. We sat down last week in a very special place, in the pair of seats on the rear car of a brand new Green Line train. We hit record right when we got on the train in St. Paul's Union Depot, and we hit stop as we exited at the new interchange station over by Target Field in Minneapolis. So not only did we have a great conversation all about David's research, the pros and cons of the Green Line, and the future of transportation in the Twin Cities, but this podcast also has a scientific value as a temporal measure of the trip, so you can ride along with us as we chat. Plus, we also have a random conversation with a guy in front of us on the LRT car who was really interested in what we were saying and had taken the Twin Cities transit system all the way from one end of Apple Valley all the way to downtown St. Paul. So there's that. I hope you enjoy this conversation.
Are you being recorded?
I'm going to start right now.
Okay.
I guess it goes down and goes back up.
Well, they should just be able to turn it around.
So hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Bill Lindeke.
Okay.
And I'm here at the, we're here at the Green Line. I'm here with David Levinson at the Green Line station. I'm getting on the train with my bike. So pick a seat, just sit down, David.
Yeah, okay. Okay, we'll sit in the back row to minimize the cross conversations.
All right. So, how are you doing today, David?
Oh, fantastic.
Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Is a special podcast, a Green Line podcast. So, we're at the Union Depot in downtown St. Paul, and we just got on the train. We're sitting here waiting for it to go. I thought we would first maybe talk about you, who you are, in case anyone doesn't know you, although that seems unlikely given the streets that I'm in. Podcast listenership.
Sure.
And then just a little bit about your research and stuff and what it's about. And then we'll talk about this train and then about the future of transportation in general. How about that?
Okay, sounds good.
And we'll time the whole thing. So what time is it now?
It is 1:08 p.m.
Okay, the train
leaving Union Depot.
Just left. So tell us about you, David. What's your research and background and where do you teach and whatever?
So I teach in the newly renamed Department of Civil, Environmental, and Geoengineering at the University of Minnesota. I teach transportation things. I teach transportation engineering, transportation economics, transportation policy and planning, transportation geography. My background, I grew up in Maryland. Most of my childhood was spent in Columbia, Maryland, which is a planned community, which got me my interest in urban planning, city planning, so I knew I wanted to be a planner when I was in elementary school.
Is that in Montgomery County?
No, it's in Howard County.
Okay.
Or Howard County, as the names would say it.
Is that how you say
it? Yeah, and then I went to college at Georgia Tech, did a year of planning school at Georgia Tech, did my summer internship in the Montgomery County Planning Department, part of the Maryland National Capital Park and Planning Commission, so the agency was MNCPPC/MCPD. I was in the Transportation Planning Division, and they offered me a transportation planning job, so I didn't see the need to finish a planning degree to get a planning job when I had a planning job, and then I switched to get a master's degree at the University of Maryland in civil engineering, and then sometime in the mid-1990s, 1994, I entered the University of California, Berkeley to get my PhD, and I was out in California for 5 years before coming to Minnesota in 1999.
I'm curious about that switch. What's the difference between planning and engineering in your kind of conception and experience? Like, why did you make that choice?
So, when I was younger, when I was a child, I had a childlike image of what planning was, and I thought that transportation planners would draw lines on maps, which I thought was really cool, because I like drawing lines on maps.
Yeah, who doesn't?
Making better lines and erasing lines and moving lines and things like that. And then I went through a lot of things. You know, I was going to be an electrical engineer for a short period of time, then worked in the industry, and that wasn't very interesting. And, you know, obviously a different experience might have changed, you know, changed the course of human history. But I went back to civil engineering as a way to do transportation, transportation planning, more urban planning than transportation, specializing in transportation, I guess. And you sort of, it's so process driven. You don't have somebody who gets to actually draw a plan from scratch. So, having grown up in Columbia, it was a master plan community. So when it was designed in the 1960s, a bunch of planners got together under the auspices and fundage of James Rouse, famous shopping mall developer. And later...
Is he like Victor Gruen's nemesis?
No, I don't know.
They worked together, probably.
I don't know if they worked together, but they were doing very similar things in the early 1960s. So Rouse was one of the very early enclosed shopping mall developers. He was based in Maryland. And he wanted to, but he had greater visions, and he wanted to plan a community. And Columbia was planned to be a city of about 100,000 people, built in very much a suburban model, but a planned suburban model. So there would be bike paths. 30% of the land was devoted to open space. It was centered on a shopping mall. There were enough roads and arterials that there wouldn't be some of the congestion problems you see with piecemeal development. Not that there's no congestion, but it's a lot less than you'd find in a lot of places. A town center, which was centered on, you know, which had a lake, and there was pads along the lake and office buildings along that. And very pleasant. There was going to be a minibus system connecting all of the villages. They built on its own right-of-way. So they built the first section of that, but there was never enough demand to support it. So the minibus system, which was named Columbus...
Oh, God. Well, you know.
Punningly enough.
It's right?
So that's how that stuff is done.
Yeah.
They continued running it, but there wasn't enough need for it to run on its own right-of-way, so they moved it back to regular streets, and it didn't run at the headways and frequencies that they imagined it would run at originally. But it was very progressive. You know, we had health maintenance organization in the late 1960s, early 1970s, you know, something that wasn't really deployed nationally until the 1980s and 1990s. So it was planned not just from the point of view of a physical plan, but there was also a social plan.
That's very unusual.
There were
a whole bunch of these kinds of things, like Greenbelt.
Greenbelt, Maryland came from the 1930s and the New Deal. This was more of the Great Society era, but this was privately funded, and there were a lot of new towns that had federal participation. There was the federal Model Cities program from the early 1970s, which helped fund Jonathan in Minnesota,
sure,
and the Cedar Riverside project,
sure,
as a new town in town. And they adopted some of the ideals of Columbia, Reston, which is a little bit less idealistic, and Irvine, California.
That's in Virginia, right?
Reston, Virginia, in Northern Virginia.
And Irvine is where the college is, and they also pioneers in bike path planning.
Yeah, and so Irvine, California is in Orange County.
Oh, no, I'm thinking Davis, I'm sorry.
Oh, Davis is not a... Davis is a railroad town, but Irvine is a planned community. So, I mean, if you're from Columbia, you'd feel very much at home at Irvine because you're planned in the same period. It's very much like a lot of the British new towns of that period, maybe, you know, from the 1950s and 60s. I spent a year in England and visited a lot of the new towns there, and so Stevenage and Milton Keynes and so on are similar in a lot of respects.
This is before, what's the name of the one that's got two, Milton Keynes? What era is Milton Keynes? That's a 30s one, right?
No, Milton Keynes is from the 1960s, probably planned in the 60s, built mostly in the 70s, 80s, still being built.
Yeah.
Very large. I mean, the ultimate build-out is going to be like 250,000 people or something.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, the early garden cities, I mean, you can trace it back to Ebenezer Howard in the late 1800s and like early 1900s, and visited Welland Garden City and
Oh, that's the one I was thinking of.
Yeah, and those are very pleasant as well. I mean, okay. It's, you know,
Riverside, Illinois is another example.
Yeah, I haven't been to that.
Have you ever talked to the guy in cultural studies that does the suburbia book, John Archer?
No.
He's a fascinating guy. He kind of knows all about this history that you're talking about.
Yeah, okay. So he's at the U?
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, I'll have him on the podcast in the future, maybe.
Sure.
We could talk all about that. Let's switch to your research in the engineering field.
Okay, so when I was working in Montgomery County, I started doing some research on travel behavior. My job was to build a travel demand model, essentially. So to make a model that would predict where and when and how people would travel in the Montgomery County, Washington, D.C. metro area. And so as part of that, I got to work with travel surveys, household travel surveys, which have been done every decade for the last, I don't know, 7 decades now in many, many places. I guess 1948 was the first one in the D.C. area to give you a sense of how long they've been going on.
And that's the kind of thing where you, like, list out everywhere you go in a two-week period?
It's actually a one-day period, usually.
Oh, okay.
So you'd have a one-day diary, and then there'd be lots of demographic and socioeconomic questions that would be asked. Twin Cities has done this as well, at least since the late 40s. The old surveys, which were, like, some of the first applications of mainframe computers, we still have printouts and reports, but the actual computer files have been lost to history, unfortunately.
Well, they'd probably be very interesting to read, you know.
Yeah, like, the reports are
before
cool.
The floppy disk, for sure.
Yes, the data is, I mean, would be a mess, but the reports are really well done because, of course, back in the day, before we had computers and layout, we spent a lot of time doing reports and thinking carefully about what we were going to say. You'd have hand-drawn maps and hand-drawn images and hand-drawn charts, and so if you look at old planning documents, they're really fascinating.
Yeah. I do look at old planning documents,
so,
and I agree with you, they are fascinating.
So anyway, I was working on travel behavior, and I got an interest in transportation economics at the time. So when I went to Berkeley, I wound up doing a project on evaluating the full cost of intercity transportation in California. And so basically we were comparing the costs of highways, air travel, in the proposed high-speed rail line, which was proposed in the early 1990s. And is,
yeah, that's still proposed, isn't
still,
it?
Still
yeah.
Proposed, but they're almost ready to break ground maybe on part of it. So we'll see if that happens.
And almost maybe part of it.
Yeah, almost maybe part of it. They're certainly not anywhere near getting enough money or resources together to build the whole thing.
We should talk about high-speed rail as part of this conversation a little bit later.
Sure.
You know, that's, I think, an interesting topic.
But, so looked at the full cost, since this includes not just the capital and operating costs, but also the social costs. And so one of the claims of the high-speed rail proponents is that it would have lower environmental costs than other modes because it's electrically driven, and airplanes are certainly going to be using diesel fuel, but automobiles are all still using gasoline as well. And, you know, I mean, of course, from an operating perspective, that claim is true, but then there's a lot of costs associated with constructing the system that you have to consider. And there's construction equipment is not electrically powered traditionally and is very big and has a lot of environmental impacts, and this is a huge public works project. So the trade-offs, I mean, we looked at it, and it sort of depends on demand levels and a lot of other things, and got some papers out of that. You know, as an academic, you measure your self-worth by the number of peer-reviewed journal articles that you produce.
Yeah.
And then I did my dissertation work on what I call the finance choice problem. How does a jurisdiction choose whether to use taxes, let's say gas taxes or tolls, to finance its roads?
Or sales taxes that have no bearing on the actual behavior.
Or potentially sales taxes. I didn't look at sales taxes, but that's a related type of question. And so basically the beauty of tolls from the perspective of a small state is that half of your revenue is from non-voters. So if you're Delaware and you put a toll...
Or Indiana.
You put toll booths to finance your roads, most of the people who are paying the toll don't vote against you in the next election. And so the states in the Northeast, New Jersey, Delaware, get a very large revenue share of their state revenue...
Capitol Rice Street Station.
...from tolls, and very little from gas taxes. So, you know, it works for them, you know... Cry me a river when they complain about transportation financing questions, but you know, they are able to offload a lot of their costs on out-of-state travelers, but they're doing it to each other. And so this is a game theory problem, so I got into game theory and as an analysis method.
Yeah, airports are always trying to do this too. It's like if you can tax the tourist or the traveler, then that's a win for the politician.
And rental cars is a huge one. And so you look at Florida. Florida's got amazing taxes on rental cars because when you're deciding to rent a car from wherever you're coming from, you don't think about the tax. You're looking at the rate and the taxes extra. Hotels is another example. And so this kind of tax exporting is just a really interesting aspect of how do you fund the things that you want. And, the famous Monty Python sketch about taxing foreigners living abroad is sort of the ideal tax system. And it is, and the famous saying, don't tax you, don't tax me, tax the guy behind the tree, right? So how do you get other people to pay for your stuff? And it's central to everything we're doing in transportation finance is getting other people, you're spending other people's money. So that got me interested in transportation economics. Came to the University of Minnesota in 1999, did some work on that. In 2000, we had the ramp meter shut down. I don't know if you remember, but that was a really big deal.
I was before my time here, but I was living in New York and Massachusetts. But
yeah, so ramp metering is a way of trying to manage flow entering onto freeways. And I hadn't really thought terribly deeply about ramp metering when I was a student. I mean, I'd been aware of it and taken traffic flow courses, as all transportation engineering students do.
Traffic flow courses.
Traffic flow theory.
I would love to take that course.
Well, you're a University of Minnesota student still. You can enroll.
Yeah, I don't think so.
But this was an interesting topic, and so went to look at the efficiency and the equity of these. And the really cool thing about ramp meters is, of course, they do increase the throughput of the freeway system and thus increase the throughput of the entire system. But what they're mostly doing, at the margins, they're efficient. But what they're mostly doing is transferring delay from people who would be on the freeways to people who are on the on-ramps. And so there's an equity question there because the ramp metering system is not complete. And if you enter the freeways well outside of the cities, you're not waiting at a ramp meter at all, whereas if you're entering in the cities, you'd be waiting at a ramp meter for potentially a long time. The meters were set up to ensure that the flow through the downstream bottleneck didn't exceed the capacity so that the freeway would remain free-flowing because we get the maximum...
I never thought about that.
We get the maximum efficiency from the system when people are traveling on the freeways at free-flow speed with a very high throughput, but just before they have to start slamming on their brakes and shockwaves begin to form and you start to see congestion forming. So you can get really close to that breakdown point but not at it if you're managing the system.
Right.
But the downside is you're putting a lot of delay of people who aren't yet on the freeway system who want to be on the freeway
system. I never
thought
about that spatial inequality. That's kind of interesting to me.
And so the beneficiaries of that are suburbanites and the... people who don't want to use the freeway for short trips are then thus people in the urban areas. And we saw this because they shut down the system for 8 weeks.
And it's so rare to have like a real life experiment like that. So it must have been really exciting for you.
Yeah, as a researcher, it was great. And I mean, I'm not sure if this is true, but this is perhaps the largest semi-designed experiment.
Semi-designed, political.
Politically designed, but it was designed to be an experiment. It wasn't designed by scientists, but it was designed to be an experiment of the effectiveness of the system. So they actually, I mean, it was conscious decision as opposed to a natural experiment like the I-35W bridge collapse, which was unfortunate, but also provided a lot of opportunities to learn things about travel behavior.
Absolutely. But yeah, that was not planned, I think.
No, that was not
You're
planned.
You're not a conspiracy theorist about the 35W bridge?
No, I mean, there are things that could have been done to avoid it, so it was sort of, there were some negligence things involved in it by not doing proper bridge maintenance and oversight and things like that, but it wasn't somebody actively seeking the bridge to fall down as far as I can tell.
Yeah, so you run a bunch of stuff at the U of M in the engineering and geo something or other department.
Department of Civil, Environmental, and Geoengineering.
Okay, and also work with the kind of the young transportation engineer group and the CTS also, or the Nexus group?
Okay, so Nexus research group is my research group. So that's my students and research fellows.
Okay.
We have a large project within there that's starting up, the Accessibility Observatory, where the objective is to measure accessibility across the United States. And accessibility is the number of things that you can reach in a given amount of time. So let's say the number of jobs you can reach in 30 minutes. And so we aim to do that for every census block in the United States.
Wow.
It's a lot of GIS work.
Yeah, and it sounds like there's that census data about the jobs, and they're categorized by that like rubric that's been around forever, right?
Yeah, and so, I mean, this is just going to be looking at jobs, but then follow-on studies or specialized studies can look at jobs by category. So yeah. we have another project to do that for the Twin Cities area to look at excessive, and starting, part of it is to look at the accessibility of how many jobs of particular industry sectors you can reach and income categories you can reach. And then part of that is to try to understand the effects of improving the accessibility on the productivity of that sector. So do wages go up when there's more accessibility? Generally, that's found to be true, but it might be not uniformly true. It might be more true in some fields than others. You know, you'd imagine that the finance sector cares a lot about accessibility because they locate
Victoria
in downtowns.
Or like the Google bus that's like this thing in San Francisco, right?
So... Well, I mean, the Google bus is a way of getting workers who live in San Francisco to the Googleplex down in the Silicon Valley.
But they're intentionally manipulating that accessibility sort of...
Right, they're trying to make it so that their workers can have the accessibility to Google not be too strenuous while they can live in an environment that has accessibility to all the amenities that the workers want in San Francisco. San Francisco, a lot of people like San Francisco.
How do you feel about it, David?
I lived in Berkeley for 5 years.
Oh, okay.
That's
like San Francisco.
It's like San Francisco in some ways. San Francisco has a lot of merits. The highest merit it has is the climate is fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, it's like pleasant year-round. I can wear a sweatshirt in August and the same sweatshirt in January. You know, I really like that. The downside, of course, is that climate attracts a lot of people who don't necessarily... feel the need to be as productive as the people of Minnesota do.
I see.
Okay, so
so now you found the opposite of that.
So in Minnesota, you have people are only going to be in Minnesota because they feel the advantages of Minnesota in terms of, you know, the combination. I mean, of course, the culture here is pretty good, but, that you know, it's a very productive place. It's got a certain, don't mean to offend any Catholics, but Protestant work ethic that, you know, a very more serious type of thinking about things. Much cleaner here.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so people care about their environment a lot more here than they do in San Francisco. You know, there's certainly a greater tolerance of diversity in the Bay Area in a lot of ways. Although Minneapolis and St. Paul are pretty good about that, but you know, you get outside the city, it's not as progressive as the Bay Area is in general. So you got these trade-offs. I mean, all places have trade-offs.
Yeah.
You know, it's very expensive there because the weather's so nice, and that's part of the downsides of the Bay Area. So you can't afford to live in as nice a place as you can here for the same amount of money.
So the reason we're on this topic is because of this thing about accessibility and transportation. And maybe we can, now we're at Lexington, which is, I think, 3 miles from downtown St. Paul, and approximately 20 minutes have gone by. Wow, that's not bad.
Yeah.
I guess. Let's talk about the Green Line for a little bit. What do you say?
Sure.
I know you just wrote a post this week about some observations, random thoughts you called them.
Yes.
And I want to start with one random thought about just when we were coming onto the platform at the Union Depot, which is someone on the Twitter had complained that the platform isn't in the middle, which if you have two tracks and they're both headed in the same direction, right, you want to have the platform in the middle so that you go to the platform and then whichever train is leaving first... Well, that's the one you get on, right?
That would be a good idea.
Yeah, but instead they have platforms on the side so that a train comes and you're on the wrong side of the platform. Both platforms are going to St. Paul. It's really kind of dumb. That's just my first observation.
That's a valid observation, I believe.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's reasons to have the platform separate, and in part it depends on flows and so on. I don't know whether that was... thought through or not, one hopes it was thought through, but I think there's a lot of things that are on designed this way because it was a legacy of much earlier designs and they didn't want to redo an environmental impact statement.
Okay. Was the idea that it would continue somehow further
so,
past?
Right, I mean, if it were to continue down the Gateway Corridor, which there are certainly proponents for an LRT out to Woodbury or Stillwater or Hudson or Madison or Milwaukee or something. You know,
Eau Claire, I believe, was the proposed destination in the scoping study.
Yeah, that then it would not be a terminal station. But of course, it probably would be a terminal station for at least some of the routes. And it's just sort of silly that you don't know which side of the track to be on. And that's an easily solvable problem.
They could put a sign up saying, you know,
which one's next.
Yeah.
And they should be able to do that with a variable message sign, but clearly they haven't been able to get their variable message signs to work either because they don't. They tell you to please check schedules.
Which is,
I mean, it was bad enough that the blue line was doing that, but this is brand new. I mean, they should have been able to get that working somehow. And I'm sure they're working on it. I just don't know what attention they're
I don't think they're working very hard on it. I remember having a conversation with somebody in Metro Transit who said, well, you know, it'll come every 10 minutes, so it doesn't matter. And I think it does matter. I think there's a symbolic importance to the certainty that, oh, I have 2 minutes to wait or I have 12 minutes to wait. And knowing that is such a comfort for people. It's why smartphone apps are so popular.
I agree. I mean, the amount of wait time is reduced when you have information. The amount of perceived wait time is reduced. Because you have certainty and you don't have the anxiety. You don't have to keep thinking about it.
Yeah, or wondering.
Right. I mean, there's other
Can I go grab a donut at the donut place real quick?
Right. And so, I mean, that's another thing. I didn't put this in my post, but many transit systems have on-platform vendors. So
right.
People who are selling snacks and magazines and, you know, used to be cigarettes and other types of things. And you don't see that here. And, of course, that adds to our cleanliness, but the price of that is that you don't have the ability to buy things while you're waiting at the platform, and that's a, you know,
it would be a good source of revenue. Coffee in the morning. You drink coffee?
No, I am.
A lot of people drink coffee.
But a lot, I agree that a lot of people drink caffeine in the morning, and I personally a caffeine teetotaler essentially, but yeah, I understand it because I mean I used to be addicted to Diet Coke.
Diet Coke.
And I'd have that, especially when you're programming computers, having the caffeine surge is like really important. But it, you know, it uses up your brain power for the day, so I prefer to have a more even firing of my neurons rather than a lot of firing of my neurons in the morning and fewer firing of my neurons in the afternoon. But that's a personal choice. So I think we're missing opportunities here. By the design of the system, and I don't know how easily that would be to retrofit given the size of the platforms, and you know there might be places you can do it and other places you can't do it. But information is important, giving people something to do is important, giving people a place to sit is important. Not all of the stations have benches, some of them have these lean-on things, and I'm sure that's to prevent people from sleeping at the stations at night, but on the other hand, they're not comfortable and not everybody's the same height, and people leaning against those things who are shorter are not going to be as comfortable as people who are leaning on those things who are taller.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, someone Facebooked that. So when did you first ride this train now? You've been on it like almost a half a dozen times now, right?
I think actually more. I rode it on Saturday. I rode it on the second, apparently the second train to arrive.
Down there on Saturday too. I actually was trying to use the train to get somewhere, and I was kind of pissed that it was like not running on time. I had to go to this thing. I had a band gig to play at the opening. Anyway, I was trying to get somewhere, and I was annoyed.
Did they play? I mean, did your band?
No, it was. We got blown away literally by the wind and rain.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is an interesting problem of opening day, but you understand. I mean, his opening day is sort of unusual.
Yeah, I took the bus instead, so it was fine.
And the Green Line bus was, of course, ahead of schedule.
It was the 21 I took.
Oh, you took the 21. Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, the train is here. It's
now
operating.
Snelling, by the way. Snelling. 131.
You can see the lovely Spruce Tree Center, of which every city should have no more than one, but having one is probably okay.
Oh, it's so horrible, David. Look at the little fake windows. This is one of my peeves, is when they have windows, but you cover them up with like some sort of decal so you can't actually see through them.
But they could be real windows. I mean, that's not a fault of the architect.
No.
That's a fault of the use of the building.
Right. There's actually a lot of people on the train right now.
Yeah, middle of the day. And the train seems to be running basically on time without too many delays.
Yeah, unlike some of the other trips that you want to tell some stories about that?
Well, I mean, they're not profound stories. I rode it back and forth to work on Monday and Tuesday just because I'm a transportation geek, not because it's something that's really terribly practical for me. And two of the times it was on time and it saved me time over walking, and two of the times it was late and cost me time over walking.
So what's your balance if you keep me score?
So right
like
now,
minus 10 or something?
Well, I don't know my balance of time. 50% of the trips have been late thus far.
Yeah. What do you think that is? Just because there's still some glitches and some cars in the way or
there's
something?
There's still some glitches. There's still cars driving on the tracks. There's still, I think, problems with the traffic signal timing that it need to get worked out. And I hope that people are working on it. I'm not satisfied that people are working on it and should have been worked out while the train was running for tests over the previous 6 months. But, the train
I just
really
heard an announcement, but I don't know quite
lights.
What it said.
The in-vehicle variable message signs would tell you what the next station are also not necessarily accurate. I think it's accurate at the moment.
I noticed that too.
But sometimes they'll tell you you're going in the other direction. Sometimes they're one or two off. Sometimes they're going in the wrong direction.
All right. Okay. So let's say hypothetically that some of these glitches get worked out, right? Like the timing, the signal timing, the signage. We're taping a podcast about the Green Line train. Do you have any thoughts about it?
Mostly about you guys.
Okay.
Are we too loud?
Huh?
Are we too loud?
No, not at all.
Oh, okay.
It seems to be extremely negative on the train.
No, we're just pointing out things that we would change. But okay, so David, this man has told us that we're being negative. Do you have anything nice to say?
Do I have anything nice to say? I think it's popular. I think
there's a lot of people.
I think
on it.
The people of the Twin Cities, or Minneapolis and St. Paul at least, have put a lot of their hopes and dreams and aspirations on this train.
I know I have personally.
I think that there, if you think about economic development as a consensual hallucination, that this is an organizing principle. If everybody believes that this will happen and that we should build here, people will build here, and because people build here, everyone builds here, and so it will reshape the land pattern in this corridor.
I think that's going to. This is the thought that I had.
Question. Either of you been to any other large metropolitan area with adequate mass transit?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
I just got back from San Francisco.
Okay.
And spent a week, 2 weeks in California without renting a car, and used mass transit for the entire time. Had a great time. For me today, I live in Apple Valley. I came to the bookstore here at Snelling and University, all by train.
Yeah, and the folks at Snelling and University, that bookstore did not want this train to happen.
No, they're the number one people.
Like
that
it now.
Oh, yeah. Is that what he said to you?
Yeah. He and I sort of got into a tiny argument.
Well, good for you. You know, that's great.
It's, we used to have one of the finest mass transit systems in the country. They tore it up so that somebody could get paid off by General Motors. Fact.
No.
It is a fact.
Well,
they did,
Derek, why don't you,
they did tear it up. I will not doubt that they tore it up. But the reason for tearing it up wasn't a General Motors payoff. I mean, it was
part of it.
Not here. I mean, it was tore up. There was a conspiracy here. People went to jail here over it. But it wasn't about General Motors. It was just about people making more money from buses than from having to reinvest in the streetcar system. In 1950s, the streetcar system was already 60 years old. It had to be recapitalized. It had to be rebuilt. Who was going to pay for that? Streetcar ridership had been going down. There was no revenue to rebuild the streetcar system in place. Buses are beautiful from that perspective because buses can free ride on the roads that somebody else is paying for. Buses were new and modern, and streetcars were 60-year-old technology. So it was the belief in buses as the future of transportation. Now, that doesn't mean that was necessarily the best decision in the long run. But given where they were and given the long trend in dropping of transit ridership basically from 1923 through the 50s, except for World War II, making a major investment in transit was very difficult. Everyone was enamored with the automobile. There was no money to recapitalize the transit system. It was a private company at the time, Twin Cities Rapid Transit here. And so Twin Cities Rapid Transit was publicly held, and they had to show to their stockholders that they were intending to maintain a profit. And while they were profitable in the 40s, they were beginning to lose profitability by the 1950s. Now, the local story is really interesting and involves bribery and embezzlement.
Yeah, and a notorious mobster.
And mobsters and all sorts of cool things. but not General locally, it's not really about General Motors locally, it's about this other stuff. But that wasn't, but the general trend, and this happened not just in the U.S., I mean, this happened in a lot of countries. I mean, London gave up its streetcars and replaced them with double-decker buses. Why did they do that? Because double-decker buses were more efficient from an cost perspective. And there, it was owned by the government. I mean, it was owned by the government from the 1930s, and they made this conversion. Lots of Western cities did this. You know, the cities that didn't do that usually either had special circumstances. San Francisco kept its cable cars and its streetcars because the hills required electric traction. It was very difficult to do with buses. Seattle is similar. Or a city that was relatively poor like New Orleans.
Well, what about Philadelphia?
And
Raymond Avenue.
Or Toronto.
Toronto, I mean, is Canadian, so they're a somewhat different story.
Because they have the different...
But Vancouver switched to electric buses.
Yeah, okay.
And so, you know, and the North American story, I mean, is different than the European story. I mean, Paris moved to buses mostly. Many Western European cities did. Not all of them. The Eastern European cities kept their streetcars because they didn't have the money to switch over.
Sure.
So... It was a perception of the economics at the time. Now, in retrospect, we can say, well, if you're going to be building the streetcars now, you should have kept them then. But we're 60 years after that point. I mean, 60 years was the whole life of the streetcar. We would have had to recapitalize it at this point anyway. I mean, sort of if you think about it, the technology is having a 40 to 60-year lifespan. So these are complicated decisions, and what you should have done then is not necessarily the answer for what you should do now. And so what you should have done if you had stayed on one technology path is different than the best answer from the technology path you're currently
at. Here's
the
thing that I think is interesting is the land use and transportation feedback loops, right?
Yeah.
Which is what we were talking about. I really appreciate your comments, by the way. It's about how I believe that this train will change people's behavior, not just because it's faster or more convenient or cheaper to get where you're going, but also because the whole feel of the street is different now. Like walking down University Avenue or living in one of these apartments that we just went past that are near these Carlton Lofts area. This corner in particular, Raymond here, is going to be a place that people hop off their apartment and walk a block and go catch the train and never think about driving a car at all and maybe never have to encounter much traffic in their daily lives. You know, you could probably lead a week of your life like that if you had the right job and circumstances.
Yeah.
And that to me is a kind of a revolutionary change.
And I think it affects certain demographic groups more than others, and I think we should be honest about that, right? So this is really appealing to people who are not time constrained, right? If you're time constrained, going from downtown Minneapolis to downtown St. Paul by transit, certainly by the Green Line, is a lot longer than driving or even the 94 bus. If you have to go and take, you know, people who are time constrained typically are people with full-time jobs and with children, are going to have a lot harder time using something like this than somebody who has a job maybe or is going to school but doesn't have as much of a, have to be somewhere at a particular amount of time. That doesn't mean it's a bad thing, but just keep in mind what the market is. Now, apartment living is another example of this. There's a certain demographic group that wants to live in
there's
apartments.
There's more than one demographic group, though. There's older people as well. And
sure.
Episcopal homes are the example that we passed a little while ago.
There's multiple demographic groups. But there are also demographic groups that this doesn't work for. Again, doesn't mean you shouldn't do it, but you should keep that in mind and not... I think we make the mistake of overselling things, and when it doesn't solve all the problems, when it doesn't solve congestion,
that's like, what you call the like delusion.
The hallucination,
consensual
hallucination,
concentric or something. What did you call it? Consensual.
Consensual hallucination. So that's more about the land use.
That's about economics in the market and marketing.
All things are consensual hallucinations. We believe that this dollar bill will be worth something because we all believe that this dollar bill will be worth something. But the moment somebody stops believing that, the whole system, enough people stop believing that, the whole system begins to collapse.
Sure.
And this happens in other
West
countries
Page
all the time.
Station.
Hasn't happened in the U.S. in a long time, and that's a good thing, but that's a real risk. So if people can believe that this is where development's going to happen, developers are going to say, well, if there's other stuff, then my people who will rent in my building will have access to other things. They'll have access to coffee shops and shop and stores and bars and music clubs and all the other things that in particular 20-somethings want. And you just look right here at this is Westgate. You've got the Dunn Brothers Coffee. e-vapor store, which just moved in.
E-vapor.
And Snap Fitness. Okay.
And then a vacant lot, we should add.
And a vacant lot, which they're promising something, which is supposed to have a bicycle bar, which is a bar appealing to bicyclists.
Okay.
If you looked at the most recent renderings.
I think all bars appeal to bicyclists.
This is
going to
have like
expertise.
It's a bike up bar.
Oh, okay, I see.
So people are supposed to be able to bicycle up to the bar and use it.
Can we talk a little bit about stations and station areas and what your thoughts are about different opportunities and sort of spots along here?
Yeah, I mean, this was billed as any number of things, 2700 The Avenue, and we're at Emerald and University right now, across from the Wells Fargo and across from KSTP at the Minneapolis-St. Paul City line. There's an opportunity there for a very large building which will house lots of people, which should have ground floor retail, which could even have been an office building. And they had a building there that was occupied until the mid-2000s and then was cleared, and then the recession hit and nothing new was built there. And then you look a block away, and there's Asphalt Driveway Company since 1951.
Well, yeah, for a long time, that particular driveway was really shoddy, and I thought it was so ironic. But they finally repaved it about 3 years.
And we have auto care centers. And nothing wrong with auto care centers. You need auto care centers, but it just sort of shows, A, the changing nature of University Avenue.
Sure.
Is moving from what was once a streetcar line to an automobile route.
Yeah,
back
all the car dealers were on the street.
All the car dealers back in St. Paul, back to being something that's a transit-oriented street, but the transformation has not occurred. And so you have a lot of these one-story buildings. They've been referred to as, you know, taxpayers because they were built to pay the taxes on the lot until a real
building could be built.
A bigger building was built, and many of them are just permanent. You know,
you call them taxpayer what?
Taxpayer buildings. That's how I've seen them referred to.
Okay. You know, I actually think this station is one of the stranger ones. It's like
Prospect
this,
Park.
The decision they made to take this train off of University move it back behind off of where the transitway is by the stadium.
I believe firmly this is because of the accident of history that they originally planned to tunnel under Washington, and because they needed to tunnel under Washington, they needed to approach Washington from north of University, and so they used this alignment to do that. Then they decided not to tunnel under Washington to save money. I mean, I think that was a good decision. But they didn't reroute the line because they already had the EIS on this part of the line and didn't want to go through that process again. So because of paperwork, they took it off of here. That's what I believe. Now,
because of paperwork, that's the answer for everything now, right?
Well, I mean, it's a shame that it affects a 60-year decision, like where does the light rail station go?
Yeah, there's some interesting land use opportunities right around here that they'd probably still be alive if the train was on University instead.
Well, right. I mean, so you have some... I mean, you're basically moving the station a half a block from where it otherwise would have been.
Yeah.
And you see some development here in
walking distance, yeah.
Yeah.
Walking distance. That's actually a really interesting variable, walking distance, which is that how far will people walk to get to a train, get to a bus? And that varies a lot by culture, even by kind of body that you have or attitude.
And the environment, and whether the environment is pleasant to walk down or not.
Right.
And
I'll walk like a mile in New York, but I won't walk very far in
people
east side
will,
of
people
Paul.
Will walk a mile in a shopping mall who would never think of walking a mile down a street.
Yeah.
It's climate controlled, and there's things to look at, you know, and so... Can we make our streets better? And not to turn our streets into shopping malls, necessarily.
Oh, please not.
But, you know. And, okay, so now we're approaching the Stadium Village station, and then there's a lot of land the University of Minnesota owns and hopes to develop.
I hope that they do. I mean, that service parking lot is real nice. It actually looks pretty new, but...
Brand new.
Yeah.
Because they had to replace a lot of the parking that went away with some of these other buildings in the stadium.
But what do you think of the three extra stops that were put on University Avenue? Western, Hamlin, and Victoria.
Stadium Village Station.
So, I mean, these are all trade-offs. So you're trading off better access for locals to the system for worsened access for long-distance travelers. And, you know, I don't know offhand how that nets out. There's functionally a limit to this. I can understand the equity concerns there because those are, you know, why are you passing by these neighborhoods and aren't these the neighborhoods that you dissed the last time you did a major infrastructure project, I-94, through their neighborhood?
Yeah, this is a coincidence.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's a coincidence, but I understand that. It's sort of solving some of the equity problems by doing that, but then the cost is an extra 3 minutes on the runtime, and that's 3 minutes for every person who's making the run every day for 60 years. And so that's not an inconsequential amount of time. And the question, again, you know, the Green Line is not a commuter rail, somebody said, and it's certainly true. And the question is, well, should there be a faster transit connection between downtown Minneapolis and downtown St. Paul with maybe one stop between the cities?
Yeah, it's the 94 bus.
And, well, it could be the 94 bus, and people propose
it was a lot faster when it had a dedicated right-of-way on the shoulder, and now it doesn't, thanks to the $35 bridge and one other bad decisions that were made. But now it just runs back and forth like a pendulum without stopping at all.
Right, and so, you know, should it stop at Snelling? I mean, people are arguing about that. I don't have a strong feeling about it one way or another, but I can sort of understand if the Snelling area is an important transfer point, then, yeah, you can. It would serve a lot of people. It would take ridership away from the Green Line. So I think a lot of what we do with our bus lines is aimed at making sure that the rail lines have as many passengers as possible, which is more not about serving the customer, but about maximizing certain metrics.
Well, that's the other thing I was going to bring up, which is that the Green Line is sort of a talisman or a fetish, you know, for catalyzing transit investment in other ways as well. So these trains are like they didn't just build a train. They also took all that money and invested in buses in tons of different ways and changed the 94 and added the 83 and did a bunch of other stuff, increasing frequency on certain lines. And they're investing in the ABRT system. It's going to feed into the train. So it's all sort of connected. And I feel like those bus investments might not happen if we didn't have these sort of magic trains to kind of like catalyze people's attention and political will.
Well, I mean, a question of, you know, sort of the political will, I don't know. But you certainly... It's certainly technically possible to have made many of these bus improvements and more bus improvements without having spent $1 billion on the light rail line. And so the arterial BRT, it should have been done decades ago. I mean, there's no reason that, you know, wasn't done.
I agree with you right there. I mean,
it's not like there's some great discovery that was made in the Twin Cities in the last 5 years that we couldn't have implemented it before. I mean, this is something that was a well-known technology for many years that's been deployed in many other countries that... While it's not as necessarily as smooth a ride as the train, because buses are rarely as smooth as the train, was a much better ride than the buses would be currently, faster because of the pre-boarding payments, and faster because you can board from multiple doors.
Sure.
And
it's not rocket. Well, it's, you know,
it's not rocket science.
No,
it's good execution. It's good management.
Yeah.
And that we couldn't. We still don't have the arterial BRT system.
The money isn't locked up yet, but it's definitely plans in the works.
Certainly,
at least in St. Paul, which is all I care about, really, David.
Well, now you're in Minneapolis.
Yeah, well, speaking of which, we're at the U campus now, going through the East Bank station. This has been one of the biggest changes along the route, I would say, is the taking Washington Avenue, not building a tunnel like we were talking about earlier, but instead turning into a transit mall. How do you think this has worked out?
Well, taking away cars from Washington Avenue is a great thing. I hope that I played some part in that. It's sort of like my only.
Because we just went past your office.
Yeah, we went past my office. My only fingerprints on the design are attending some of the meetings with the University of Minnesota folks, telling them that taking cars off Washington Avenue will be okay, which I think it has been okay mostly.
Yeah, the world did not end.
The world
people
will not
are still
end.
Learning things.
Not that there aren't people who still try to drive down Washington Avenue in the bike lane, and Metro Transit Police are making a lot of money ticketing them.
Oh, good. That's better than ticketing the bicyclists.
But the design is over-signaled. There are far too many traffic signals. I had a post about that, but I've got another post just sort of describing some signals that, as far as I can tell, are actually functionally useless and functionally detrimental to the...
Tell me the quick two-minute theory of the idea of sort of information and noise and traffic signal and signage, you know?
The idea would be that, you know, you're going to notice things that stand out in the environment, and things that stand out in the environment are things that are relatively unique. Okay, so if you have one sign in an environment, you'll see it because it's otherwise in a background of things that are not signs. If everything is signs, you're not going to notice any sign. If everything is a signal, you're not going to notice any of the signals. If there are a lot of them, you don't know which one's for you because they're confusing. If you can see the signals that are downstream or the signs that are downstream, you don't know which ones you're supposed to pay attention to. And so there's just...
So you end up with a sign saying, please pay attention to the sign next to the sign.
Essentially.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think this is a Metro Transit problem. I think this was a traffic engineer problem.
It's a problem with everything, with 24-hour news media, or whatever.
But everybody's screaming for attention, right. And so, you know, how do we make our environment cleaner? And one of it is, you know, sort of with new technologies, eventually we might be able to take away signs and everybody gets only a heads-up display on the particular information that they need at that time. Okay, some sort of virtual reality or augmented reality type of scenario. But we're not there yet. And so we still need physical signs, and we'll probably need physical signs for a long time. And, you know, I mean, if Google Glass is our future, then we probably need some help. But now we've got our first delay of the trip. We are stopped on the bridge over I-35W.
That's nice. You can. This is one of my favorite spots to sit and look at infrastructure.
Yeah, and I mean, the cool thing is that, you know, if this train is moving, you're taunting the cars that are stopped in congestion.
And now it's the opposite is happening.
But now it's the opposite. So, you know, in the Washington Metro, they have some trains that go over the beltway, and I'm convinced it's for exactly that purpose of taunting drivers.
And I've seen Metro, so you can see there, they just made an announcement that's saying the next station's the last stop, and then the announcer conductor had to come on and say that that wasn't true. So they're still working out some kinks there, also with the automated voice person.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't know what sets it off, but I would have thought that would have been like GPS triggered, in which case they shouldn't have those kinds of mistakes. But,
yeah.
But maybe there's some other or sensing system which isn't GPS based.
What do you think? Should we be forgiving or not?
Well,
I feel like they had months to work this out.
They had months to work it out, but they didn't have any passengers for those months, so maybe no one was paying attention in the passenger seat to the wrong information.
I would have gladly taken that job. Sit here and complain. That's what we're doing right now.
For free.
For free.
Yeah, so we're now passing the People's Stadium with many, many cranes.
Yeah. Boo.
Yes, our guest on the podcast has a thumbs down on the People's Stadium.
Would you share your name?
What?
What's your first name?
Bob.
Well, thanks, Bob, for your contributions.
You guys are live?
Yeah. Well, no, we're recording.
We're recording it.
But it won't be edited very much.
So we can edit you out later. No, I'm kidding. I won't. I'll leave you in. Yeah.
So now we got our second delay. We made a little bit of progress, but we're not quite at downtown.
You know,
we're held at a red light.
The signal timing thing, especially in the downtown areas, is kind of frustrating to me. But I understand why that happens because
it's a safety issue.
Well, it's more than a safety. Ideally, it's a safety issue, but I think some of it is just sort of it's an engineering issue that they haven't optimized it yet, and that there's still some work to be done.
But, I mean, we're talking about the trip through downtown Minneapolis and the blue line, right? It also goes very slowly, and you can beat it almost with a bus. Certainly will beat the train through downtown, I think. Yeah, won't it? I'm pretty sure.
I think so.
Certainly on my bike, I can do laps around the train.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, I have to head south.
Thank you, Bob. Thanks for...
I'm headed all the way down the red line.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow. You've got this is a three-line day for you.
Yeah, you're doing the whole gamut of the transit network. I'm proud of you.
And I have no time constraint. The fact is that I just had an eye operation, and I can't really drive safely, so this is the only way for me.
Well, yeah, that's great. You're a good testament to the future of transportation in the Twin Cities.
I just came from California where I spent a month without getting on a car.
Well, how did that make you feel?
Nice. You have to drive. I hate driving. I really do.
So why do you live where you do if you hate driving?
Because I didn't used to.
So you hate driving now, but you used to hate driving.
That's right.
Okay. So people's preferences change.
Yeah, well, that's kind
of... Some of the preferences change because you have options, and some of it because you're...
When I worked in downtown St. Paul, I took the bus from Apple Valley. I was one of the few people in my office who did that. Took a bus from anywhere. And it was sort of an interesting thing that the management had to realize that some of us have to leave on time. When you're an exempt employee, they expect you to work till whenever you can leave. I couldn't do that. So it was a little hard for some managers to get used to that idea. There are other schedules that you had to meet.
To me, that points out the kind of interconnections of these decisions that you end up studying, David. It's like how they're not just a simple personal preference, but they depend on your work, on your home, on your family situation, on your physical mobility issues, like you've got a medical situation right now or whatever. So there's a million things that come together to bring. So long, Bob.
So have a good day.
Yeah. To make our worlds and our choices and our capacities and our mobility options, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, it points up another thing is that, you know, the suburban transit routes only have a very few number of runs per day.
Yeah, right? That's frustrating.
So, you know, if you're in a job where you can leave at a fixed time every day, or you can convince your employer that you can, then that's great. There's a lot of people who aren't in those kinds of jobs, and having transit service, if not 24 hours a day, but at least 18 hours a day with some regular frequency, is important. And having, I mean, this is sort of the question of, do you spread the service out like peanut butter, or do you concentrate it and have higher frequency? And we've made, obviously, I mean, there's a trade-off between the two. We've spread it out more than I think we should.
I agree with you. Yeah, I wanted to be focused on the places that have actual walkability, which is a smaller, much smaller. Apple Valley would not be in that category, probably, except for maybe one route.
And Apple Valley, I think, is working on building a downtown, town center type of place, but it's mostly vacant lots now. But they've got a grid there, and you can sort of see that they're hoping to have more of that kind of development. But I don't know if the market will support it, and, I mean, if the demand will be there. I mean, you know, if the Twin Cities had 10 million people, we'd have a very different type of situation than a metro area with 3 million people.
There's a big F.
Well, certainly. And, you know, but you can't expect San Francisco Bay Area level transit in a metro area with half the population is sort of the phenomenon. But you can certainly do better than we've done historically. I mean, with historically in the last few decades.
Yeah, so let's talk about the future then. I know you're a proponent of a bus system that's very robust and frequent, and investing in that. And you also had an interesting sort of interview on MinPost this week about how to fund that kind of a thing.
Yeah, so I think, you know, the future is uncertain, as we all know. So we want to look for transportation systems that are as adaptable as possible. And I don't think we think about adaptability when designing our system. So how, you know, is it flexible? Can it do multiple things now? So the Metrodome was really flexible. It could serve as a baseball stadium and a football stadium and a lacrosse stadium
and a
monster truck rally, you know. Yeah. So it was very flexible, but it wasn't really adaptable because we had to tear it down after 30 years because it didn't suit the needs, needs in quotes. I hope that you can all see my quotes. The needs of the time of having a football stadium.
For the record, you did not make quotes.
I did with my fingers, but they were pointed down. So
okay.
I thought about quotes. It wasn't adaptable to serve the quote needs unquote of the time. You know, the streetcar system was not able to adapt to the suburbanization of housing and automobility that came about from the 1910s through the 1950s. And so it disappeared. Now, if we had a different land use pattern, if we had a different funding for automobiles, if we had a different set of taxes on automobiles, the world would be a different place. So one of the difficulties in doing any kind of planning is, what world are you designing for? And the answer is, you're designing for multiple worlds. You're designing for today's world. You're designing for tomorrow's world. You're designing for a world 10 years from now and 30 years from now and 60 years from now. And you don't know what the world looks like. You've got a pretty good idea what it's going to look like tomorrow, but you don't know what it's going to look like in 10 years, much less 30 years or 60 years. I mean, 15 years ago, you know,
who would have 15 years ago,
what is the world like?
Yeah, 1999.
20 years ago, what is the world like? That's before most people have internet access.
Yeah.
Now, how much time do most people spend on the internet in a given day? How much shopping do people do on the internet? Well, a lot. We can measure this in the travel behavior statistics. The amount of time that people spend shopping has gone down. Okay?
Because we're about to go through the Nicollet Mall area where all the department stores are closed, except for one.
And
basically.
So, right, I mean, so the downtown shopping died well before that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that was dying from the 1950s with suburbanization as the stores wanted to follow the residents
out. Southdale.
So Southdale and all the Dales in the Twin Cities region. And then even those did not adapt to the times very well.
Well, they have to be continually remade. That's the thing. You have to constantly reinvent them.
Sure, but Brookdale didn't make it, and Southdale's struggled. Mm-hmm. I mean, Rosedale is doing okay, I
guess.
Honestly,
I have a secret wish that Amazon drives all the big box stores out of business. Like, I don't know. That's kind of my secret desire. Think of the land use impact to that, right?
Well,
you'd have, like, giant Amazon warehouses out in outer space land, but you wouldn't have any of these freeway strip commercial areas.
Right. I mean, so the world would look a little bit different. You wouldn't have to see those kinds of strip shopping with the parking lots, but you still have to have a logistics system, and how do people get stuff? So the question is, do people go and fetch their stuff at stores, or do people have stuff delivered to them via UPS guys, USPS, FedEx, or eventually robots and drones? Okay, well, you know, pneumatic tubes. That was from the 1887.
Yeah,
we go back
kind of
to Bellamy's Looking Backward. And,
yeah, yeah.
And pneumatic tubes, I mean, we don't use them much.
Just at the bank.
They used to use them in the department stores. London had a subway system just for freight traffic from the postal subway system. So it was just moving mail and packages around London to different post offices.
These are examples of transportation options or networks that are not adaptable, you would say?
Well, I mean, nothing is perfectly adaptable. You can't adapt to everything that you don't know about, but some things are more adaptable than others. And so can you design a system that's less brittle? And, you know, there are certain corridors that will probably always remain corridors. I mean, the Green Line is probably going to remain a corridor for a very long period of time. I have a lot less confidence that the Southwest LRT or the Bottineau Line will remain an important corridor in the Twin Cities region over a similar length of time. Might not. If you build it, it's more likely that it will, because you've made an investment there, and people, again, the consensual hallucination, people believe that that will be important, then it will become important. But I think that we're drawing lots of lines on maps to places that have relatively low probability of
being... Like Woodbury?
Relatively low probability of becoming important corridors. I'm not going to comment on any particular one of those, but you can imagine, but Bill can.
Excuse me. No, I didn't say that. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, University Avenue is... that's why I really like investing in transit, where you have these density already existing.
Yeah, and you already have the density downtown, and that it sustained the density in downtown Minneapolis for 100 years is an indication that you've got a better probability of sustaining it here than you do in a place that's much newer. Just because people have already shown that this is an important place, and you've already got the anchor reinforcing the investments that you have here. You already have the high accessibility to jobs. But what happens to jobs? I mean, this is when you think about the future, will people be going to work 5 days a week, 8 hours a day in 20 years? Some people will, some people won't. My guess is fewer people will be doing that in 20 years than are doing that today.
Yeah.
And we're making all our investments, if you look at the maps, to reinforce the downtowns, although the downtowns haven't even gained employment in the last 50 years and are unlikely to be gaining much employment over the next 50 years.
Well,
so we're solving yesterday's problem.
Okay, yeah. But we're also designing everything around the concept of the rush hour.
And rush hours, I mean, we're certainly spreading out demand across the day, and that's fine, and that of itself doesn't mean that light rail is a bad thing. I mean, it means you want a high frequency service throughout the day.
Which this is, and it's going to go all night long too,
and overnight is especially valuable. There's a lot of people who do shift work and have unusual hours, and you know, or choose to drink alcohol in the late evening, for whom transit's an important option. So, you know, the question isn't necessarily that this should or should not have been built, but the question of what market are you trying to serve? And I think that thinking about this in terms of the 1950s model of people going to work 5 days a week, 8-hour days in peaks, which is the mental in downtown, working in downtown, which very few people in the Twin Cities region do.
Yeah, and Minneapolis is relatively high downtown office jobs.
Downtown Minneapolis is stronger than most downtowns are in terms of, you know, the density of employment in the downtown area is one of the highest density in the U.S. for the core area. I mean, very tall buildings in a very small area. So, you know, Minneapolis isn't the worst place to be making this investment. This argument is stronger in other metropolitan areas. You could think about Phoenix or something like that, where a much smaller share of people work downtown.
Yeah.
So it gets to the question of, well, how should you finance your transportation systems? And, you know...
You got to sum up now. We're almost to the last...
Yeah, and so my view on this is that we should be thinking of them as public utilities, not as branches of government, but as something that is successful, that can pay for itself. And I don't think that there's a... in many countries they do pay for themselves. I don't think there's a good reason why the highway system or the transit system in the United States couldn't in principle pay for itself through user fees primarily, through land value capture as well. So allowing the transit system builder also to develop land use around the stations to help pay for the capital costs
of
the stations.
That's the classic way of doing things. And instead that's what we're giving away that value basically to whoever is the lucky enough person to have the right deal in their pocket.
That's right. And those folks knew about the lines on the maps before most people did and made wise investments and helped to jigger the economic
to
and political system to favor the investments going through their real estate rather than somebody else's. And again, I'm not commenting on the Green Line, but you can imagine systems in the Twin Corridors in the Twin Cities where that is true. Proposed corridors in the Twin Cities where that is true. So if we could have a transit system that got the benefits of the development, that would help defray a lot of the costs of this. And we're going to have to be thinking about new funding sources for a variety of reasons. Gas tax will go away as we electrify the auto fleet. Federal government seems to have lost much of its interest in funding local transportation, and so there hasn't been an increase in the federal gas tax since 1993, and doesn't look like there's going to be one anytime soon. So I guess here we are at Target Field Platform 1.
Is this the interchange?
Well, this is Platform 1, so I think there's one more.
Well, let's go to the end.
We got to go
to
the end.
What time is it now? 2:11. It's an hour and 5 minutes after we left. What do you think of that time?
Well, time flies when you're talking on a
podcast. Yeah, actually, that's the kind of concluding remark I have, is that if, as long as you're in a good conversation, it doesn't really matter how long it takes. It does, of course. That's cool. Where are we going to leave this?
So, readstreets.mn, become a member.
Oh, yeah, let's definitely do those things.
Bill needs more podcasting equipment. I can see the equipment that he's using. He definitely really does need new podcasting equipment. Hopefully the sound quality was good, but I'll only know that in retrospect.
I'm excited about this train. I think it's the best transit project, train-wise, that we're going to build in my lifetime.
Well, it's the best transit and rail transit project that we have in the Twin Cities.
Just because the other ones are so stupid.
So... here we go.
Well, you press the
button. We have to actually press the button to get off, and we have now exited at 2:12 p.m.
Great. Well, thanks, David, for
thanks
riding
for
the train with me,
and
I hope
MN
everyone
podcast.
Enjoyed it.
Again, please consider joining
Thank you for the interview.
MN.
Good
if you appreciate this podcast or any of the streets.mn content, you can click on the blue button on the right side of the page, hopefully, and you'll click on there, and you can become a member. If you have any feedback or ideas, you can comment on streets.mn, on Twitter at streetsmn, all one word, or you can email me at blindeke@gmail.com. So long from the Interchange Station in downtown Minneapolis.